There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you? Okay, Max, the budget is tight. We gotta make this show for 50 cents, and we do not have time for retakes, alternate shots, or any of that other fancy schmancy Hollywood art stuff. So, get on your mark, and please, this time, make sure you get your line right.
Yep.
This is our last bit of tape. We don't get this, the whole show is ruined. Okay. Mics are on.
Yep.
Tape to speed.
Yep.
Get that pony off the soundstage. I do everything myself. All right. Lights. Camera.
This week on Max Mike Movies.
Action. No. 1,000 times fired.
Sorry.
What is a person to do to get this production off the ground? I bet Roger Corman was never surrounded by such new series here on the podcast. We're taking a look at one of the biggest film directors to ever live near Hollywood, Roger Corman. The series, Be Like the Corman. And we will.
Be the Corman.
Well, we'll take a look at some of his movies anyway. We just lost Roger, so we thought it might be a good idea to give him a second or even third look. And who's we? Over there, huffing deep inside his diving helmet, is Max Robot Monster Levine. Give us a take, Max.
I can't see a thing in this diving helmet.
Brilliant. And me, I am the clapper to his gaffer. Mike, this is the best boy loose. House of Usher is the first film in this new series, an adaptation of a Poe short story directed by the Corman himself. Before we get to the poll question, let's check in with this week's sponsor, Maison de Velour.
Ah oui.
Maison de Velour is an American winemaker that handcrafts their wines the old-fashioned way, with hands. Mm. That gives it the old-world flavor true connoisseurs have come to expect. And this week, they've sent a bottle along of their newest wine, or vin, as they say, Peter du Chat Beaujolais. Let me pour you some, Max, here.
Ooh, thank you.
Never seen a pull tab on a bottle of wine before, but that's some of the forward thinking we've come to expect from. Yeah, pour a little bit here.
Very nice.
Yeah, here's some for you.
Nice color.
Yeah, that is an interesting color, isn't it?
I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
Well, that's because they're unique.
It's
but
unique.
Anyway,
sure.
The bouquet is.
Yeah, it's
piquant without being presumptuous.
Yeah, I'd say it's more obsequious without being indirect.
Yeah, that's well. Anyway, here, Max, let's take a sip of Peter du Chat.
Mm.
Oh dear Lord! That is the taste of failure.
Oh God! It burns.
What is that? Seville du Motel 6? Right.
Oh my
no
God.
More.
I can taste my childhood trauma.
No more, Maison de Velour. You are bumpy fired. If anyone, and I mean anyone else out there would like to sponsor our show, give the pony
Please.
A jingle. Let's get to the poll question so I can cleanse my palate of this.
I can't feel my face.
Poll question.
If you remember last time, we were aching to know if you still watch the Oscars or any other award shows, and if so, why? If not, well, why not? Here's what you had to say. Vince, our international friend from north of the border of something, wrote us via the website.
Mexico?
We're north of the border of Mexico. I guess technically so is he.
Yes. Yeah,
anyway. He wrote us via the website, quote, I never watch award shows. I just find them dull, and I don't think they do a good job of picking the best films. Here in Quebec, I wonder what that is. We have what seems like hundreds of them, and it's a good reason to keep the TV off, end quote. Well, a big chilly no from the King of Penguins. Wag, 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 wag. Thanks, Vince. Next up, George Saulnier with, quote, I watch the SAG Awards because I'm a member, and I go to a viewing party to network badly. Otherwise, I could give two bleeps about the award shows. I think giving awards to something that is to be judged subjectively is stupid. I don't think they should give individual awards, but rather 5 or 10 best lists. Once artists reach a certain level of technique, quality becomes too nuanced to be objectively assessed. Can one really say that De Niro's Jake LaMotta is that much better than John Hurt's Elephant Man? I can't. They're both brilliant performances. Appreciate both. End quote. Well put. Thanks, George.
Yeah.
Tim Potter wrote, quote, no, never have. I find they are totally irrelevant. It seems like it's just a popularity contest. If you know the right people, you win. Not if the film is actually of any quality, end quote. Well, he does have a point. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, well, what can you expect from old man Potter?
He's not old, and his name's Tim.
But he is a man. There, I've run rings around you logically.
Have some more Maison du Velour.
Don't you dare! That declared a war crime.
Adam Mark had some words, and these were they. Quote, I watch the Tonys, for the musical numbers, since you don't get to see them otherwise, and plus it's always an enjoyable show, and the Oscars, since sometimes people slap each other and other winners get miscalled, etc., la 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 la. Seriously, though, the Oscars are enjoyable, especially now that they don't do those impossibly long movie montages. Whether you love it or love to hate it, it's one of the few mass-watched live broadcasts besides sports in the U.S., end quote. And across the world. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, he's right.
Dave posted, Dave. Quote,
I decided the Oscars were dumb in 1977.
I know he said it just
before
like that.
It was cool.
Yeah. It was mostly because of Rocky, but I also think I saw On the Waterfront and decided that the Oscar was not a reliable measure of quality or really of anything. I like the monologues, but mostly those shows irritate me. Why on earth is this one popular? What is wrong with these people? They are choosing best without objective measurements, end quote. Well, true enough. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. You ain't wrong.
Nope. Val Coons. Say, have we mentioned the podcast Q Footsteps lately? It's no, not like
no.
It's not like Max and I are in it or anything, but right, where was I? Oh, right. Val Coons, dictatress of Q Footsteps, said, quote, I do, mostly to see what everyone's wearing and to see clips from the smaller categories, foreign and shorts and animation and films I don't usually get to see. As I mentioned before, I think most award thingies are popularity contests, not real indicators of the best of the best. I can't stand the opening monologues. The making fun of the attendees makes me cringe. Some of the acceptance speeches are inspiring, though, and worth a peek, end quote. What are people wearing? I can save you 3 hours, Val. Clothes! Thank you!
Technically, some of them, meat products.
Someone's going to show up once with antiperspirant, and that will be their costume.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, that's right, that happened, and it was David Niven who got to see it. Anyway, Brian Mundo stepped up with, quote, I just watch for the commercials. Oh, wait, no, that's not the right one. Puppy Monkey Baby still haunts my dreams, though, end quote. I have no idea what he's talking about.
What's that? I do.
What is it?
Oh, God, it was from... The thing is, I don't remember the product, but it was the idea that they had... This marketing company had decided, what's the cutest thing we can do? What are the things people think are cute? Puppies, monkeys, and babies. So they created this Cronenbergian horror... That was a fusion of a puppy, a monkey, and a baby.
I'd like to go with you for 200.
Yeah, yeah, that was it was terrifying.
Well, thanks, Brian, I guess. Nick Hoffman gave us, quote, I watched them religiously for decades as a wannabe industry guy, and even though I made some inroads, my wife many, many more, we both stopped watching and lost interest when the movies we adored were consistently ignored, end quote. Yeah, that does happen a lot. Thanks, Nick. Mm. Jamie Kleinert's answer went, quote, no, for two reasons. One, I'm not normally seeing more than one or two new releases per year. And two, we don't have cable or local TV, just streaming. And I don't want to mess around with streaming broadcast stations for awards. I'm sure there's a way, but I'd rather spend time doing other things and catching the interesting nuts and clips the next day. End quote. Editing. That's what these shows need. Editing. Thanks, Jamie. Roland Hardy said it all in just four words. Quote, it's a bad habit, end quote. That and many other things.
Yeah, you know, that kind of does sum it up very well.
Thanks, Roland. Richard Tatum, shut up, answered, quote, gave
get it rid of the Tatum! Ha! I will not be silenced.
Here, have something to drink. It's delicious.
Nah, get that away from me, you monster!
Richard Tatum answered, quote, gave it up years ago from disappointment from everything from the choices to the often poor production quality. How is the Emmys always the worst produced show for television, end quote. A question whose answer we may never know. Thanks, Richard. Lastly, we have Matt Reisman's answer, quote, no, I just don't care. They feel so self-aggrandizing, and I've come to understand that the opinions of these academies don't matter to me. They rarely tell me whether I'll like something or not, end quote. Well, it looks like the no's have it. Thanks, yeah, Matt.
Sounds like.
What about you, Max? Well, actually, I know your answer is the same as mine.
I never watched the Oscars. I certainly have not watched them regularly for over 40 years.
Yeah, but why do you watch, Max? And does it mostly rhyme with Bob Snow? Rob Lowe.
Oh. That was why I started, although that was how I started watching it over the phone with our mutual friend Libby.
Hi, Libby.
Back when the Rob Lowe Snow White dance happened.
Mm, or did it?
When our national nightmare began. I remember calling her and going, did I just see what I thought I saw, or am I having some kind of a cerebral event? And ever since then, we just watched it over the phone. Now that we're back in the same area, we often watch it together. And sometimes we, out of sheer pity, we drag some decrepit little urchin off the street. And me too. Yeah, him. Yeah, the three of us watch every year, although I think Mike's getting more and more fed up with it.
I wouldn't say that this year. I will admit that I prioritized a D&D game over the Oscars. I was in for the very end, though. I have made it for the last 30... I think I showed up in, 89, 890?
Something like that.
The last 34 years, 35 years.
Yep.
I'll admit, I only watch them because Max and Libby watch them, and it's a nice thing to do with my friends. Otherwise, I honestly don't care. Although every once in a while, like the year that Moonlight won, I was like, I'd seen Moonlight in the theaters and thought, this should win. There's no chance it ever will. And it did. Every once in a while, the Academy does the right thing. I remember the year that we watched, Max and I were just trying to watch as many of the nominees as possible. Mm. Max usually gets them all. I usually don't. Mm. And one of the films I watched was Million Dollar Baby. And I thought, there is nothing I'm less interested in than women's boxing, but I'll go see it. And of all the films I saw, I was like, you know what? This kind of deserves to win. It's really, really good. And it did, Yeah, we watch because we like the pain.
I don't know. Sometimes I enjoy it, and I like depending who they have hosting it, it can be funny. And also, it often presents me with movies I missed that I wouldn't have otherwise either heard of or seen. I don't mean like the big ones, but like the foreign films or the documentaries.
Yeah, because it's often, I like documentaries, and we're going to be talking about one a little later, and I often just find out about them by chance, sheer chance, so there you go.
Yeah.
But the poll question shows no sign of slowing down as long as you folks provide the coal for... See, answers help speed the train of our... never mind.
Let the metaphor die quietly.
Yeah, just answer if you would. What is your favorite period for filmmaking? The 70s and its new Hollywood and rise of the blockbuster? The 60s for the wave of imports? The 80s for its films? Let us know. The answer may surprise you. Casting that aside, let's toss our line. Okay, no more metaphors, just facts about House of Usher.
Don't make me hit you with this empty bottle of Maison de Velour.
You drank it all? Oh, no.
It's eaten through the floor.
I see. Never mind the glass.
The facts.
Budget.
Oh, God, it's trying to crawl into the trash barrel.
Let it. Budget. $300K, that's $300,000 for those of you who don't speak metric. Take.
Most, I assume, went to Vincent Price's mustache.
We're going to get to that, but take somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million bucks. Hey, this Corman might actually turn out to be something.
And they say he's always made money, except in one exception.
Yeah. Speaking of the budget and Vincent Price's mustache, a third of it went to Vincent Price.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it didn't go to anybody else because I never heard of anybody else in this movie.
Luckily, I think this is, if it's not, it might be the smallest cast of any film we have done so far. There are four people in it, but we'll get back to that.
Well, you're not counting the ghosts.
No. This film was actually considered shocking in its day, with Harrison's Reports, an industry trade magazine, printing, quote, although a bit too wordy, the abundant gore... Photo gimmicks, special effects, and unusual theme help keep the viewer on his seat's edge, end quote. Gore? What gore?
Yeah.
Oh, they have no idea. None. Oh, you innocent lambs of the 60s.
Yep, you sweet summer children.
that burning set that falls down towards the end, that was real. Corman learned of a nearby barn that was going to be demolished, so he convinced the owner to let him burn it for the final scenes. And it worked so well, he used the footage in other films.
Okay.
He's very, very efficient. Speaking of fires, that desolate ground where our hero rides through at the beginning of the film, that was no fake either. There had been a fire in the Hollywood Hills. Shocking, I know. So Corman, sensing an opportunity, brought everyone out to film there. This was Corman's first color A picture for American International, despite its rather B-movie feel. He was usually given a budget and told to make two B-movies with it. This time, he was allowed to use the whole budget on one CinemaScope color release. It was also the first standalone American International feature, as they usually just released horror or sci-fi double features. This was the first in a run of 8 adaptations Corman would make of Poe's work. The film was shot in 15 days, and that was the longest he'd ever taken for any film up to that point.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
The movie was released both as House of Usher and The Fall of the House of Usher for reasons known only to American International. While known for shooting fast and loose, Corman was anything but. His storyboards were so tight that he rarely lost any scenes to editing. The myth of his shooting everything in one take, like William One-Shot Bodine, was false. Yeah.
Oh.
And since we're doing a series on a single person, let's add a little trivia about the main man himself.
Yeah, tell us about the core man.
The core man was native of Detroit, so there. He was born in 1926 and just died a few weeks ago in 2024. Amongst his many accolades, he was the youngest filmmaker to ever receive a retrospective by the Cinémathèque Française, the British Film Institute, and the Museum of Modern Art. And yes, he did win an Oscar, albeit an honorary one, in 2009. He also handled the American distribution for some really well-known foreign film directors, such as Fellini, Bergman, Truffaut, and Kurosawa. And no, I don't mean Larry Fellini, Bob Bergman, Louis Truffaut, and Hilda Kurosawa.
Hey, Hilda Kurosawa never made a bad film.
Or any film. There are several more episodes, so we'll add to the legend of the Core Man, the mists of legendary of the Core Man as we go along. For now, let's mosey on up to the plot. It's some time ago, and a young man is riding his horse through a barren wasteland that surrounds the dreaded House of Usher and title of our film. He's come from Boston, a mythical city somewhere in the United States, to seek out his fiancée, one Madeline Usher, and bring her back to Boston. Strangely, he wants to spend the rest of his life with her. Thing is, he's not exactly welcomed. The Usher's butler, Bristol, tries to shoo him away, stating that Madeline is too sick to leave bed. But strapping young Winthrop will not budge and insists to at least speak to Madeline's brother, Roderick, before leaving. Roderick is a fey man, whose senses are heightened to the point of nearly driving him mad. He, too, tries to send Winthrop away, even pleading at one point that he leave. Winthrop won't hear of it. Madeline enters, and Winthrop is more sure than ever that he needs to bring Madeline out of this house of madness and away from her brother's control. And he does try. Roderick continues to tell him to leave. Winthrop keeps plotting to take Madeline away. Suddenly, Madeline dies, supposedly due to a strain on her heart brought on by Winthrop's fighting over her with Roderick. So she's buried. But it seems they were a bit premature. She suffers from catalepsy and her death wasn't real. Winthrop tries to find her and release her, but his initial efforts are in vain. Roderick, who can hear rats scratching in the walls, is being driven mad by the sounds of Madeline clawing her way out of her coffin. When Winthrop finds out she's alive, he searches everywhere until the still-living, but quite mad, Madeline finds him and tries to kill him. Winthrop is saved by the butler, but Roderick is the next target. As she strangles her brother, the house, supposedly the source of the family's evil, more or less sets fire to itself. It's all Winthrop can do to flee and save himself, though the haunting images of the house and all within will, seemingly, haunt him forever. And they all lived happily ever after.
The film. Yes, I would like to point out that at the end, the House of Usher burns down, falls over, and then sinks into the swamp.
But the last one stood up.
But stayed up.
So, Max, had you seen this before?
I had never seen this before. I'd read the story.
Yeah.
And I've seen the Netflix series, which is very loosely based on this.
Well, I mean, let's face it. I think the original story is like, it's like 10 pages tops.
It's like, yeah, it's like 12 pages. It's very short.
So there's a lot of room for, let's see, artistic
padding.
Well, speaking of which, so this film starts, we had another film that started this way. I think it was 2001, where it's very confusing if you don't know what's coming, because all you see is a black screen and hear a bunch of music. And I decided to warn Max, although I could have been mean and not, because I watched it first and I was like, just so you know, there's nothing wrong with your TV set or the copy of the film.
I appreciated that.
Yeah. I have to say that that felt kind of like artsy padding. Because I don't know what purpose it serves.
Well, it was going to be a single released film, so I guess he needed it to be longer than a lot of his others.
I honestly thought that might be the case. So, yeah, I hadn't seen it either. I actually have never seen any of his Poe films, of which there are plenty. And we may see another one during this series. We'll see.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of others over the years.
So it's first time for both of us. Let's talk about the cast. It won't take very long, because most of the cast is literally listed as uncredited because they play ghosts that don't say anything. And I'm going to guess most of them were
very
friends.
Scary.
They were friends or
key grips.
Yeah, best
people
boys.
Wandering by.
Yeah, because I want to get to Vincent last, just because we have Myrna Fahey or Myrna as Madeline Usher.
Also known as Myrna Turner.
Hi. She's fine.
Yeah. She's very pretty. She's a good damsel. She's not terribly convincing as the maddened, crazed, super strong Madeline Smash!
Hat, go to sleep.
But, you know, she does what she can.
I think she's fine. I mean, here's the thing I want to say real at the beginning of this series. I've seen a bunch of Roger Corman films. They vary in quality. I think that's fair to say.
But that's one way to put it.
The ones I've seen in general, he gets decent performances out of people. Even It Conquered the World, which we may or may not see in this series. You know, it's got Lee Van Cleef and Peter Graves, and they're fine. Even though they're fighting a giant cucumber, it's fine.
But you forget that man is a feeling creature.
That's not the beginning of the end. No, I guess that is
To Conquer the World. It's the same one. Yeah.
So, she's fine. Our hero, I guess, which we'll come back to, Mark Damon, his Winthrop.
Hey, come on, everyone's famous. Matt Damon? Who knew he was in this movie?
Mark Damon, no relation. Mark Damon.
Oh, so his dad. All right, well, his dad is pretty good. No, they're not related
at all.
Oh.
As far as I know.
Sure.
Yeah. Well,
he does have a lot of face.
Well, he gets more as he gets older. But his forehead grows like the mighty oak. he's
Mark
fine.
Damon is like, hello, I am generic hero.
Yeah, and he's fine. And as the hero, I want to talk about him. Actually, we can talk about him now. As far as the plot goes, he's meant to be our hero, but I sure don't see him that way.
Now, he's kind of a jerk, especially to Madeline.
I think that's actually my note, is that Winthrop is a jerk.
I mean, admittedly, he's supposed to be, I guess, early. Well, no, you see a flintlock pistol, so like late 19th century.
Oh, it was a long time ago, Max. Quotes and trademark. A long time ago in a place somewhere. Yeah. He's fine.
In Ushervania. Yeah.
Yeah.
Adequate. Yeah.
Yeah, he's fine. I had any problem with his performance. I didn't have anything exciting to say about it. Harry
quite
Ellerbe.
Forgettable.
Yeah, if I've seen him, apparently I have seen him in other things. I didn't realize it, so it's fine. Harry Ellerbe plays Bristol.
Super Butler.
He is.
I mean, you see how easy he picks people up?
Well, it's everybody, like, here we go. Everybody takes a turn at picking up Madeline at one point.
Yeah. Either these three guys are really strong, or she doesn't weigh anything.
I'm going to go with probably the latter, unfortunately.
Probably.
But yeah, he plays fine.
He's very likable. He's a little sinister at first, but mostly you get the feeling he's just in a decent person in a terrible situation.
Yeah, he has a little bit too much makeup, other than that, I don't know if it's restored or not, but the print I watched, I rented it, was really nice, so the colors were very, very vibrant. But yeah, he's fine.
Yeah, I rented it too, and it was. I thought the thing was out of focus half the time.
There are times when the focus does slip.
But, yeah, kind of a lot. And then we come to Vincent. Yes.
I got to say, Vincent's a delight. I really enjoyed
Vincent. He does not work as a blonde. I'm sorry.
That was weird. And of course, he lost the mustache, which
yeah,
I think it's to make him look younger. They do leave out one part from the story. He and Myrna are supposed to, or sorry, Madeline are supposed to be twins, which no.
We're not twins.
Yeah, no. I thought he was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed Vincent Price.
He is. He's also, for Vincent Price, he's remarkably restrained in this part.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, especially if we ever see Pit and the Pendulum,
yeah,
then he's like, ah, scenery.
See, I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Yeah. He's more fun then.
Yeah.
But he's very kind of tragic in this. And I think he does a fine job. It's, yeah.
You know, obviously it was worth it because that the film made, what was it, six times its budget or more. So, you know.
Yeah, when your budget is, you know, $5 and a pack of cigarettes, it's not that hard.
Yeah, but we're talking American International. For them, it must have been like, oh my God, our stocks just went up 1,000%. So, although, I didn't realize that one of the people who owned American International was Samuel Z. Arkoff Samuel L. Bronkowitz, if you wish, because looking at that documentary, I'm like, oh, this is where Kentucky Fried Movie got all of its fodder. It's all from Roger Corman.
So, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So, yeah, the four people in the cast, because that's all it is, work fine. Yeah. Wow. Corman, CinemaScope, would not have seen that coming. That's a big deal.
Yeah. That's way more money than you'd think he'd spend.
Yeah, well, again, this used to be the budget for two films, and they said, go ahead and spend it on one, and
he always said he would never make a movie for more than $1 million.
Yeah. I don't know if he actually did, but
I don't know if it counts, because it was never released.
Oh.
But the movie that men are not wont to speak of, Fantastic Four, that was well over $1 million. I think it was $3 million.
Yeah, that one we might have. I don't know if we can do it or not, because I don't know if we can find it anywhere. But
also, he didn't direct it.
Yeah, so no, he produced it. Yeah, oh, that's true. We weren't going to do it because he didn't direct it. But
yeah,
that's because apparently at one point he actually owned a chunk of the film rights for Marvel characters, because Marvel was going downhill.
They were selling it to anybody for pretty much anything.
Yeah. And the deal was, one of those things where if you don't make the film, you lose the rights. So he made the film. And I've seen it. It's, let's see, what's the word? Terrible. Yes, that's the word.
Yeah.
However, it's honestly not that much more terrible than the other two attempts that Hollywood has made.
Nope. Unfortunately, there seems to be something about that movie or that story that nobody's been able to do right. Maybe, Marvel Studios is going to try in the next year or two, so we'll see.
Sure, great. Can't wait for that, Got to say, as far as direction goes, he doesn't skimp on the camera angles. He's really moving the camera around in this, which is, I don't think in the other films of his I've seen, I haven't noticed the camera work one way or the other, but this time I'm like, wow, he's really trying to do some interesting stuff here.
Hmm.
What did you think?
I suppose, mostly I have to say I found the slow pacing kind of annoying. There is a lot, I mean, whatever that critic was saying, there is a lot of talking in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of exposition, and there is very little that actually happens.
Well, have you read the story?
Yes, I have.
Because I think actually even less happens in the story. There's a reason
it's only 12 pages long.
Yeah, well, and a lot of people have said, us included, that when you're adapting something, you're often better off with a short story or a novella than because
you can add stuff, and you don't have to throw stuff on the, you don't have to leave as much on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, and obviously Roger doesn't like to do that, because that's wasteful, and Roger doesn't like to waste things. I thought, though, the dialogue actually felt very Poe-ish, even though the story itself has almost no dialogue. It's all narration.
I don't know. Poe's language was very formal. And while this is sort of formal, it doesn't feel as, honestly, airless as Poe often does. He's got more poetry to his language also. His is more elegant.
A tree.
Yes, yes.
Because I read the story right before doing the show. I'd never read the story, and I wanted to see if it was going to be a good adaptation. We'll come to that later. I think Poe writes of his time, which is mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of air in what Poe says, the way he writes. I think that things are fluffed a bit, shall we say. Not necessarily badly. I think it's honestly just that was how people wrote. And of course, when you read the story, if it's printed properly, you realize, oh, this was serialized. I think there's four parts. And because he does recaps. Yeah, there's recaps. If you remember last week, ladies and gentlemen, he doesn't actually say that, but suddenly there's this, you know, short paragraph of what happened in the last episode of Collier's or whatever. So I don't know. Am I saying that I think the person who wrote the script is as good an author as Poe? No. But I think there was an attempt to make it sound Poe-ish.
Yeah, I guess it was just to keep to the period.
Yeah.
I do have to say, when Roderick is, or Vincent Price, Roderick Usher, is describing his condition, how he has hypersensitive senses.
Uh-oh, we're going to go to the same place.
Yeah, yeah, and how his family, if when they go mad, they get superhuman strength. I'm going, okay, so he's Daredevil, and his sister is She-Hulk? I'm not sure. We've walked into a Marvel movie.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the film does predate Daredevil.
Oh, yeah, no, it does. I also have to say, do you notice how much his hypersensitive hearing comes and goes?
Talking of Michelangelo's.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, oh, the slightest, you know, amplified sound is like knives in my ear, he says in the middle of a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Where once he winces at the thunder.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Well, also, he doesn't like bright light, except there's a fire going and there's tons of candles everywhere. And
yes.
Yeah. It does come and go. I mean, to be fair, in the story, it's not really that pronounced either. You get the impression, at least in the story, that he might be an albino, or he's also suffering from, there's a condition, I can't think of what it is, where, like, there's people who literally can't stand light up beyond about a candlelight, and they can't go out, and they have their windows permanently closed and stuff. But, yeah, it's convenient. Let's be fair. It is convenient. One of the things I was going to go to the Daredevil thing too, but there you go.
Yeah.
The opening of the film, we see him approaching, and I couldn't help but thinking the film should have been retitled "The Fall of the Painting of the House of Usher." Yeah.
My first note is, maybe we can get shelter in that matte painting, horsey. By the way, he forgets about his horsey at the end.
It's true.
He's like, oh, I'm free. I'm out of the house. What happened to the horsey?
You know what I'm going to bet? They only rented it for one day.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think they just couldn't keep... in fact, not even a day. They could have shot both the scenes. They probably only had him for like half an hour.
Yeah. I got to give him credit. He got his films made.
The mounted cop showed up going, hey, I need that back.
Where's my $5? Yeah.
Carmen used to borrow stuff from everybody.
Why wouldn't you? You know, good for him. He was like one of the original guerrilla filmmakers. Later on in the documentary, they're talking about parts where they're filming and it's like, oh, we're going to shoot this. I forget which film it was. And I think it was Dino something.
Dino Shark.
Yeah. And they are looking over and it's like, huh, here we are in Puerto Vallarta. Isn't that sign in Spanish say area of crocodiles? Yeah, we're fine.
Oh, yeah. It was like, okay, Roger, do we have permission to shoot here? How do you mean?
Permission. Yes. Describe permission.
Yeah.
I got to say, that being said, even though this film is kind of claustrophobic, which actually does help the story, it's got to have a much more lavish feeling than you usually get in a Corman picture. The rooms are big.
The sets are very impressive. The costumes are very elaborate for what they are.
And if you're looking for it, I think you will realize that the endless corridors of secret tunnels are, in fact, the same corridor from different angles.
You know, I did notice that, yes.
Tons of people do this, and good for him, because if you light things differently, shoot from a different angle, it isn't obvious at all. And I noticed because I'm looking for it. I think most people probably didn't. I do have to say, though, one of the most lavish parts is the food. Hot gruel.
Delicious gruel.
I think that's my punk band, Hot Gruel.
Yeah, because nobody in the family can tolerate anything with any flavor, so I assume they're all English.
Oh, dear, still got some flavor. Better boil it some more. So when this film came out in 1960, obviously the ratings board was a little less, which is flexible than it is today. Yeah. And this was considered gruesome. And one of the things that earned it its R rating is things like the skeleton, because back then showing skeletons was...
Oh, no, bones. Ah.
Yeah, like now we just buy them at Lowe's and put them in our yard.
Yeah, 12 feet tall.
Well, and I think the amount of blood that we see, because we don't see anything until Madeline comes out of the coffin. And I bet even her, like when we see her hand coming out of the coffin, that was considered shocking in the day.
Yeah, there's like a little bit of blood on her fingertips. That's about it.
Well, then later on, there's more. And it's, she makes a little trail and we followed that. But it's obvious to... Saw. Tastes have changed quite a bit since then. I have not seen the Saw films, nor do I want to. But, yeah.
So you didn't see Saw?
No, I didn't see Saw. So
Saw went unseen. Okay.
No, I was going to go with Marjorie Daw, but she was busy that day. Where the hell she is. How would you say that this compares to... I know you're not a big fan of horror films, but this was considered horror. Would you consider it horror today?
From a 21st century, hell, even from a 20 years after this movie was made perspective, this is nothing. Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of blood, which they're not even really trying to make look that much like blood. It's red liquid.
Yeah.
But there's no wounds. No one's getting decapitated. Honestly, Corman had already made movies like Bucket of Blood. Things that were a lot gorier than this. This was, it must have been the distribution level that they were pickier about it, because this is remarkably tame.
Yeah. Shocking is not a word I would use to describe this film, but it's very interesting, I think, culturally, to look back and realize that this was considered shocking and what you could and couldn't do in films. And I think in Britain it got a double X rating, because...
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, X doesn't mean the same thing here as it does there.
Not then, yeah.
So I wasn't scared. There's one quote in there where they're talking about the house and how it used to be a paradise around. And one of the quotes is, "Animals came trustingly to drink." And then I added, "Yeah, plastic animals," because there's this plastic lizard stuck to a vine, and it's like, I know you got that at the fair. I mean, that's fairground green.
They would come trustingly to drink. And then we would shoot them.
Yeah.
I also have to say, the portrait gallery, the Usher family did not really go in for hiring people who would make them look good in their pictures.
Well, the idea is...
Because they all look terrifying.
Well, the idea is that Roderick painted them.
They're all supposed to be his paintings.
Yeah.
Okay, I missed that.
So those paintings were all...
That makes a lot more sense, because,
those paintings were all done by a guy named Bert Schoenberg, which I looked up, because I actually really liked the paintings. I thought they were cool. And it's sort of like one of those night gallery things. It's like, where did those paintings go? Who did those? And apparently everybody kept one. Strangely, Vincent did not choose the one of himself. Roger Corman kept that one. But Vincent chose the one of the sea captain with the red eyes.
That was actually, I think, the creepiest. That was the one that had, like, the most expression, I thought.
And they went back to it twice. But I liked that. I thought that was actually a really neat, like, set detail, that they had that weird style and stuff.
And this is the same guy who did that portrait of King Charles recently, right?
Wow, so mean.
Kind of looks like it.
I actually kind of like it. I think the red is questionable, but if you look at the detail of the hands and the face, I actually think it's a really neat portrait, but that's totally off topic. You said you thought the movie was a bit slow and a bit expository, which I suppose. While I didn't think it was exciting, I thought it was at least interesting, and it moves along. I don't think it really dawdles anywhere. It doesn't really come to perch on any one set piece and stay there for too long. It keeps moving, trying to get the action going. But again, the story doesn't really have any. In fact, they changed a good deal of it. So did you get the point, though, when he's looking for a weapon to try and fend off the evil Madeline, and he reaches for something, anything, and we both, I don't know if you would have said this, but I certainly called out, "Seize the bone!"
Yes, that is what I have. Oh no, he's unintentional. I think in my notes, yes, he's unintentionally seized the bone.
Yeah.
And I guess... Yeah. I also have to wonder, why do all the Usher coffins look like footlockers?
Well, unfortunately, you can tell they were made to order, And I think in this case, the order came from the core man himself. They were very spacious, those coffins. You could fit like
very roomy
two or three ushers in there if you wanted to. Usher, throw these rowdies out.
That was coming in my head all the time.
Yeah. I would say that I would, instead of calling it scary, I'd probably just call it gothic.
Yeah.
Does that seem fair?
I think that is. It's a gothic in the sense that it's all about tension, which I admittedly didn't feel, but I think that's, again, we're kind of jaded at this point.
Yeah.
They hadn't seen 100 years of horror by this point.
So one of the things I did want to talk about was it as an adaptation. So we have a 12-page story, and it's needing to be made into a... God, it's an hour 16 minutes, I think is what it was.
It was 79 minutes, I think.
Oh, it's an hour 19 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I say.
Of course, three of those minutes were spent watching a dark screen.
Yeah, there is that.
Thank you, Corman. I got a nap in before I got to watch your film. So you have to stretch 12 pages out to an hour 19 or 16, depending how you look at it. I do like to talk about adaptation because it's a part of Hollywood that often comes up and often comes under overly heavy scrutiny because people, of course, are going to a movie. If they're seeing an adaptation, they want to see the book or the story that they love. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's not possible. And I think
sometimes it's a mistake.
Right. In the case of, I was going to say Good Will Hunting. What I really meant to say was Brokeback Mountain. That film could have been much different. Never mind. In the case of Good Will.
How do you like them apples?
Horse apples. Sheep apples. In the case of Brokeback Mountain, apparently the writer, Annie Proulx, really liked the way they expanded things and stuff, and it really worked out. Now, this film takes the core of the original story and basically says, yeah, we're not doing that. And it does one of those things I usually don't care for. It introduces a love story.
Yeah, I don't think there is a Phil Winthrop in the original story.
Oh, there is. He's the narrator. No,
isn't he just a lawyer? Oh, he's the narrator. Okay, yeah, but he's not the boyfriend or fiance.
He is a friend of Roderick's, and they were boyhood chums. Take that any way you want, fishhead or otherwise. And he comes, he's bidden to come by letter because of Roderick's failing health. And, you know, he wants his friend to come visit him. And you get the impression anyway that they hadn't seen each other since grade school, high school. I don't know. Yeah,
since they were spool boys.
Yeah. And then Madeline's sort of this ancillary character off in the background. And she does do the whole catalepsy thing and then blah, 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 blah. So basically, Corman says, yeah, we can't have that. We can't have this film about brotherhood. No one's going to see it. We need to introduce this love story. So my question to you is, how do you think that works as an adaptative thing?
Honestly, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's this whole thing of like, oh, yes, Madeline is too ill. She wasn't too ill to live in Boston for who knows how long, go to school, meet this guy. Presumably do the devil's tango or whatever else. And she's remarkably spry for someone who's bedridden.
Well, like,
oh, I'm in bed. Oh, hi, Phil. Run.
Yeah, we'll get to that part, too. But, you know, here's
the only thing is just to finish it out. Like I say, there's some parts of it that just seem silly. But some of it I do understand because, first off, it allows a lot more exposition. And it brings in conflict.
Right.
There isn't a lot of conflict in the original story. It's mostly just, yes. Oh, there goes the roof.
Yeah. Kinda.
This is more like, I'm taking her away. Oh, no, you're not. Oh, yes, I am. Oh, no, you're not.
My hero, I'm saved. Cursed.
Yeah.
I usually don't care for tacked on love stories. There's plenty of films I've seen where it's like action, action, action. Oh no, I must fall in love now. It's like, no, you don't. Just keep actioning. We're fine. And I really hate the idea that Hollywood seems to think that we won't watch a story if there isn't a love story thrown in. However, I actually think it works in this film. You can say, oh, well, she was good enough to live in Boston. I think the implication is she was trying to escape her fate and then realized that she couldn't. And thought she had made a clean escape by moving back home to be with Roderick, not thinking that dashing Winthrop would actually ride his doomed pony to come out and find her and bring her back to that mythical... Who's ever heard of Boston?
I know.
Whatever. So
yeah, no, that's a fair point. And like I say, it allows things to actually happen.
Right, because here's my question to you from either the story standpoint or the movie.
Mm.
What's their problem?
Whose problem?
The Ushers.
Oh, they're doomed.
Because why?
Doom, mostly. No, it's the whole... Yeah. Well, it's like, yeah. It's like when Madeline is supposedly dead, and all I'm thinking is, yeah, she... What'd she die from? Death, apparently.
Well, so...
But the problem is, and this is unfortunately biblical, but it's literally, what is that line out of Deuteronomy, of the sins of the father shall be visited unto the children unto 3 to 4 generations. It's the idea that all the ushers before them were big, stinky jerk faces.
That's not what Poe said.
That's exactly what Poe said.
Big, stinky jerk faces. Okay.
Yes, that is in the unexplicated version.
Of Olsen's Standard Book of British Birds?
Yep, that's it.
O-L-S-E-N?
The one without the gannet. No, it's the idea that the whole family were just horrible, awful, criminal, bad, naughty, wicked zoots. because of this, it somehow actually managed to taint the bloodline or become like a curse upon the family.
Well, and that's the only issue I have with the movie, and quite honestly with the story, is we don't know what form that curse is going to take. Eventually, even Madeline is like, no, you don't want to marry me because I can't put it into words. I'm going to go off screen and tell you. Like, we don't know what it is that's going to happen with her. Like, well, you could say the madness, but you could also say, well, that's Roderick's fault.
No, Roderick keeps saying, that's what happens to our family. We get older, we suddenly develop superhuman strength and become crazy.
Or superheroes.
Which really does sound like, you know, well, if only Professor X were here, he could help.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any way of hiding the fact that Roderick is, a year or two older than Madeline. Blonde hair and lack of mustache notwithstanding.
Yeah.
But he's more, as I said, fey than he is really mad.
No, he's just sort of, So he's just suffering without his stone.
It's like what... God, wow. You're going to drag that into this? Oh, remember to go to eRaggin for all your online raggin needs. never forget him in that role. Oh, Malkovich. Nope. Yeah, so I guess it's just, at least the movie, I will say, does make an attempt at giving us a reason why these people are doomed. And going to be sent to the room of questions. Boy, this is the worst deeper episode we've had in a long time.
Terrible.
It's just, we don't see anything bad happen to her until she's shoved in the box. So it's hard. I wish there was a better idea. And we see Roderick shrinking from things, which I guess is fine or whatever. Yeah. But the movie, the story really doesn't tell you anything except that you get the idea that the house itself is just a metaphor for the crumbling family that is Usher.
Mm-hmm.
But in the movie, they actually say, oh no, the house itself is the source of the evil. Every brick was brought over from England, because I guess the rates for moving evil bricks was low that year.
Yep.
And that was the source of the evil, and that's what tainted the land, et cetera, et cetera. So...
But it was tainted by the family, apparently, because they were all English, because they invented evil?
Sure. It's not clear, and I kind of wish they had made a better effort at telling us what she... Like, the idea is like, oh no, she's going to turn into the undead, it's like, okay, I should be leaving now, thank you. But this vague, no, you don't want to know, you don't... It's like, we do.
So awful.
It's so awful.
It's funny, the undead thing, that was, I knew the story, but I was like, you know, let's see, hyperlight sensitivity, we hardly ever see her eat, she never goes outside. This would be a good setup to turn out she's a vampire.
Well, and I actually felt there was a kind of Bram Stoker-ishness about this. Not saying that it was stolen, but I mean, they're nearly contemporaries. I think Bram Stoker wrote Dracula like the early 1800s. This is more of
later.
Was later. It?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh. I wonder if there's any way for us to find out that I can edit out so it won't be in the actual episode. What shall I do? I am shrinking from the light right now, which is causing a slight delay in our podcast, which, if you're listening, sounds a little something like this.
Yeah, 1897.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
I thought it was much earlier than that.
No.
Interesting. Okay.
No, he was more of a contemporary of Conan Doyle.
Huh. I really thought he was a lot earlier than that.
Nope.
How about Mary Shelley? When was she?
Oh, I think she was like the middle of the century.
Oh. Well, we'll pause for station identification. And have you considered taking Maison de Velour into your heart?
Yeah. 1797 to 1851.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and so that would make sense then, because they're both contemporaries and in a Gothic time period. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is not saying, I'm not pointing any fingers and saying, oh, he stole it. I just thought it had a very similar sense dealing with, although it's not really dealing with the supernatural per se. It's very vague. It's sort of it's like when people used to die of ennui.
or the vapors.
It's like that. So I would say in some ways it's a terrible adaptation because it totally changes the focus of the story, the relationships. It adds in a love story that did not exist. But on the other hand, to make a movie,
you often have to make changes like that.
Yeah. And I think it actually keeps a lot of the flavor of the story. It doesn't really warp things that much except for the relationship. The whole idea that the house is a representation of the rot from within, et cetera, et cetera. The doomed nature of both the brother and the sister, not being twins in this case, which is a good thing, because if there was a tall woman who looked like Vincent Price, that might be scary.
That would be really frightening.
So I actually think, all things considered, for Hollywood and the $5 that Corman had to make this film, I'm going to actually give him a little pass on adaptation. I don't think he rapes it as much as some films. But yeah.
By the way, did you catch who the screenwriter was besides Poe? I mean, the guy who actually wrote the screenplay?
Poe wrote the screenplay?
No, I mean the original.
No, I did not notice.
Richard Matheson.
Oh, that's right.
Guy who did I Am Legend and a whole bunch of Twilight Zone episodes.
Yeah, he's actually very well known, especially in like early science fiction TV and stuff, is writing very good, tight scripts. Well, that explains it. So, you know, I'm going to give a little hats off to him. I'm not wearing a hat, but if I were, I would take it off. The other thing I will take off is, I shouldn't do metaphors. They don't.
No. You'll hurt yourself.
I'm at the end of my notes. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the only thing I have is, boo, I guess. We are scary ghosts.
Yeah,
and also, did the storm throw a grenade at the window? Because at one point, it literally bursts into flames.
That's how evil it was.
Ah, okay.
So evil. yeah.
Other than that,
I mean, we're talking Richard Burton Exorcist 2 levels of evil.
Pazuzu, I must find Pazuzu.
In her petals.
The finish.
So, Max.
Yeah.
What did you think of House of Usher or Fall of the House of Usher, depending on where you saw it?
Okay, I found it a little dull, I have to say. It's very much a creature of its time. It's a 62 film. It is kind of a
1960. You
know, 60, sorry, I thought it was 62 for some reason.
1960.
Wow. For a Roger Corman movie, because we have both seen quite a few of them, this is very impressive to look at.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably his best use of like sets and costumes, although I'm curious. I'm hoping we can do The Raven at some point, because I have, as a child, I have fond memories of it, and I'm kind of worried about how it'll hold up.
I hope Vincent Price is in it.
He is.
Of course he is.
Yep, as is Boris Karloff, Jack Nicholson, and Peter Lorre.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but that certainly could be one of your choices.
That is one of the things about the Corman, is regardless of what you think of his talent, the man could spot it in other people to an almost supernatural level.
Yeah, but nobody's, gonna be talking nobody's about ever that. Heard of any of the people he helped
oh,
out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go ahead and name one. I dare you.
Oh, there was that guy, what's his name, named after the African country, Cameroon, Jim Cameroon.
He didn't help and, Cameron.
Yes, he did.
Did he? When did he help yes, Jim Cameron? Yes, he did.
Oh, I cannot. Oh, I just saw.
I thought you were going to pick Coppola because that was an easy one.
Nope, nope. James Cameron actually was an assistant AD at one point.
Oh,
and a couple. Yes, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Jonathan Ron Demme. Howard,
yeah,
Jonathan Demme. What's his face? Who directed the Hostel movies?
That guy.
That guy.
Jack Nicholson.
Guy did, Jack Nichol. Jack oh, Nicholson. Peter Bogdanovich. For God's sake. Oh, yes, Peter Bogdanovich, Peter Fonda.
Yep.
All the
Bruce Dern.
All these major people. Yes, Bruce Dern, Pam Grier.
Yeah, oh, Pam huh? Grier, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He. I do have to notice he didn't, it wasn't so much with the women in his movies.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that.
I'm sure you will. Mm-hmm. So you thought that, well, yeah. You're giving it a pass?
I'd say it's okay, yeah. I think especially if you're checking out the Corman oeuvre, as we are.
Did that hurt?
I think that, yes, it did. I think I broke something. I'm going to curl up on the floor now. Hang on, I got to move the microphone. It's not the most fun for me. It's, again, I think it's kind of slow. But I think it's all right. And it's certainly, it's very professional. And it's when people talk about him and they try to mention him in the same breath as Ed Wood.
No.
It doesn't work because Ed Wood was just so untalented, he went through untalented and came out the other side into something else.
Mm.
Corman was not incompetent.
Nope.
He just worked with very little money.
And did really well with it, generally. Yeah.
What about you? It sounded like you liked it more.
I'm going to definitely go along with your assessment that it is a product of its time. It is not a movie I think holds up to today's audiences really at all. It's got a very languid pace, which, to be fair, is very similar to that of the book. Not even a book. It's a story. I think that the performances are, again, very much of their time. I enjoyed watching Vincent Price, but it's a bit much. The word subtlety is not in his vocabulary. No. And that's fine. It works for its time period. I mean, this film is 64 years old, right? So it is an old film. And films were very, very different then. That being said, of the films I've seen of Corman's, it definitely has the highest production values. And I think that him and Matheson do a decent job of adapting what is otherwise a film that would be literally a camera aimed at two people talking. I mean, that's kind of all it would be. And they don't even talk much. One of them plays the guitar or whatever. Or this one, in the case, it's a lute. One of them paints and the other one watches the other one do these things, which, you know, and then, the crazy person shows up at the end. The house doesn't even burn down in the movie. It just falls apart. Mm. So,
and the book collapses. I mean.
So,
yeah,
for Corman, I think I've heard this is one of his best, which may have been a mistake on my part, because if I chose his best for his first film in our series,
why not?
Well, but that doesn't mean you can't have fun with things. So
no, we will absolutely.
See. So I would say, if you're interested in watching films about made by somebody who really just managed to go out there and make films and actually,
lots of them.
Yeah. And kind of be at the forefront of the whole, what would eventually be the auteur filmmaker thing in the 70s. This is the guy to go to because he inspired a lot of people. And let's face it, he got his stuff done and he made money. So
he did.
Good for the Corman.
He did. Good for him and good for us because we've still got a poll question that Mike has to tell us about.
We do.
Yes.
So what is your favorite period for filmmaking? The 70s and its new Hollywood and rise of the blockbuster, the 60s wave of imports, the inventiveness, as we found out, of the 90s, which surprised us. Listen to our entire series on films of the 90s.
Mm.
The answer may surprise you. Mostly it'll surprise us, I hope. But what won't surprise you is how you're going to tell us. You can email us directly at us@maxmikemovies.com. Go to our website, maxmikemovies.com, where you will find all our episodes. You can leave comments there, as does Vince and sometimes Cheese Boy. You can talk with each other if you like. You can give us suggestions for films that we should watch or series we should do. You can tell us that you loved our show. You can tell us you hated our show. You can sit there quietly and not type anything like many of the thousands of the listeners that I'm sure we have. You can go to Facebook, where you can find us under Max Mike Movies. Leave your comments there. Last of all, if you like podcast apps, any podcast app, pretty much we're there, including YouTube, audio, music. Video, music, YouTube, music.
Sound-making thing.
Because Max and I have sung on occasion, much to your displeasure. But also much to our displeasure, we're going to continue the series on The Core Man. And Max, how are we going to do that next week?
Because we're going to be a man, be a core man.
Thank you, Zorak. And,
yes.
Oh, dear, we're going to get letters.
I like saying Zorak.
Give us a break. Give us some dinner.
Now, next week, well, you remember the Broadway musical and hit movie had an Oscar-nominated song, Little Shop of Horrors. It was just a musical delight with the vocal talents of Ellen Green and Rick Moranis. Well, too bad, because we're not going to watch that. We're going to watch the movie it was adapted from, Roger Corman's horror comedy, Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, which I think it's got the Muppets in it. Well, one.
That would be a huge step up.
Are you saying this movie is on the cheap?
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. But until then, feed me.
Maison du Velour.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.